From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carol Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, everybody. Listen, a little while ago, we presented a collection of our favorite female Not My Job guests, a group of powerful, funny women we called the Divas. Well, we got a lot of letters from male listeners, and they were expressing, as men are wont to do, their deepest feelings. They said they were hurt. They said they were confused and sad. They wondered when would we feature men on our show, manly men, men of power and strength who were yet sensitive. Be at peace, my brothers in the drum circle. Today is that day. On this week's show, it's raining men, some of our most macho moments. We start with a guy who may seem an odd choice for this testosterone fest because he's French. However, he makes up for it by constantly mooning death. Daredevil Philippe Petit joined Carl and me along with panelists Charlie Pierce, Adam Felber, and Kiri O'Connor in February of 2009. The story, as you tell in your book and film, is just astonishing. And one of the things you say is that as soon as you saw a picture of the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, you conceived of the desire to walk between them.
Yes.
And you told people this, but nobody really either, nobody believed you enough to try to stop you.
Yeah, that's a good part about telling about secrets.
Yeah. Well, actually, one of my favorite moments in the book is when you arrive at the JFK airport with all your equipment, your balancing pole and your gears, and they asked you what you were doing with all of it.
Yeah, and I just for fun, I said to the custom agent, I am just a wire walker, and all this equipment is to put a wire illegally between the Twin Towers. So the guy came out of a big laugh and, you know, wish me luck and yell, next!
I'm going to try that next time.
So imagine the face of that custom officer when he saw, the big picture in the New York Times.
In the book and in the film, it tells the extraordinary story about how you and your Confederates managed to case out the towers and get up there with all the equipment and get the wire across. But the thing that just other kinds of person can get our head around, can get my head around, is the moment where you're up there, it's dawn on that day, the wire is set, and you take your first step off the ledge onto that wire, 1,300 feet off the ground. What did that feel like? Were you scared? Were you happy?
I was not scared, but it was very scary. And I was very happy, but not a normal Earth happiness, more of a celestial happiness. I think elation would be the right word.
Right. So blinding terror would not be the right word.
No, I had no reason to be fearful. Fearful of what?
Oh.
No, hold on.
I don't know.
Let me stop.
Maybe you didn't sterilize the wire.
You could
get an infection. You could catch your death up there.
It's cold.
Yeah. I have to say, watching your movie, I had two very strong thoughts, which is that, my gosh, that's the coolest thing. Isn't it amazing that he would do that? And I was thinking, I would never want to do that in a million years.
I have the same feeling. When I watched the film in all those film festivals, I said, this guy is incredible. And then I realized, oh, this guy is me.
Wow. And were you happy about that?
Or
were you
like, to be me, I am always happy to be me.
Apparently right. The case. Now, before that coup, as you call it, you had walked across the towers of Notre Dame. You had walked across the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Since then, you've done many others. We're told that you have one big goal. You want to cross the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, but you know, this goal is like almost past now. I mean, the project is still alive, but it's not alive as much as another project, for example, that eating me right now, which is to put my wire on Easter Island.
Yeah.
And attach maybe the cable or the rope around the belly of the Moai,
the great head-shaped statues, yeah.
Yes, and have the Rapa Nui people who inhabit the island be part of the performance with their celebration and dance and songs and music. So that would be a very beautiful show to present to the world. Of course, what I need is a guardian angel who will of the art who will sign the right check.
Yes.
But I'm not the only artist who is waiting for that.
Apparently not.
Yeah.
Wow. In the book and in the movie, it's clear that you are driven by these extraordinary passions. You would have to be to pull these things off, to put up with the risks, obviously. Do you ever find yourself, when you're exhausted, when you're worn out, when you've come to the end of some rope and you're beating your head against a wall, and I, of course, in your case, I guess, I mean, coming to the end of a rope metaphorically, do you ever find you wishing that you were normal, that you didn't have these passions, that you could just be happy watching TV?
No, I never wish I was normal. I'm very, very happy to be not normal. But at the same time, I'm of course, very normal, but I am entangled in too many passions, as you explained, and it's I don't know how to use the miserable hours that we have in a day. Am I going to write my next book? Am I going to plan my next highway walk? I am very frustrated that I am forced to sleep a few hours and stop here and there to eat and drink. What a waste of time.
Yeah.
I know you feel, because, like, I get home and there are so many different things on the TiVo.
And well, you know what?
And there's so few hours in the day.
Well, I don't have a television set.
That's the secret. That's the secret, ladies and gentlemen. One last question before we get to the game. We know you're not afraid of heights. What are you afraid of?
Well, animals with too many feet or not enough feet.
Really?
Yeah.
You can translate that into big spiders and nice venomous snakes.
All right. So you're out 1,000 feet above the ground on a wire. There's a spider.
Oh, then it's nothing. I pull out my little booklet, my how-to, and it has a chapter on spiders and what to do.
Right.
I would hit him with a booklet, personally.
Exactly.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. If it's too sunny and you cannot read the thin type, use the booklet.
Exactly. Well, Philippe Petit, we are honored to talk to you today, but we have asked you here to play a game we're calling
Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes?
So speaking of fears, you've proved, as we've said, that you're pretty much fearless. So we thought we'd ask you three questions about famous people and their unreasonable fears. Get two questions right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl Castle's voice on their home answering machine, calming them down. Carl, who is Philippe Petit playing for?
Peter, he is playing for Elena Fiore of Burke, Virginia.
All right. Ready to play?
Mm-hmm.
First question. Hans Christian Andersen, the great Danish writer of children's stories, was so beset by an unusual phobia that he took special precautionary measures. Was it A, he was so terrified of mermaids that he insisted that all women who came to meet him wear trousers? B, he was so frightened of being buried alive that he posted a sign by his bed stating that he only looked dead and should not be buried? C, he was so scared of accidentally eating another person that he insisted that he be introduced to all of his meat while it was still alive.
Well, the middle one, I would say.
You're in the middle one, that he was scared of being buried alive, so he had a sign put up, I'm not dead, I just look that way.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, sir. Very good.
Of course.
He was terrified of being buried alive. It was a very common fear.
Interestingly, that's the same sign that Dick Cheney used to have on his desk in the White House.
But I'm not terrified to give the right answer.
No, clearly. You're just
that's
right.
Why I did.
I know. That's very good. Let's see you do the next question.
It is very good.
It is. Yes. Oh, you are a proud man. All right, it is. That's great. Let's see how you do with this one. Sometimes the people who seem to be specialists in fear have the oddest phobias. For example, A, Sir Edmund Hillary, the first man to climb Everest, was terrified of cats. B, Alfred Hitchcock, master of the suspense film, was frightened of eggs. Or C, Lucky Luciano, famous crime boss, mafioso, spent his life in fear of ants.
The ants.
Lucky Luciano was scared of ants?
Mm-hmm.
No, it was Hitchcock was afraid of eggs.
Ah.
Isn't that odd?
What did he think they were going to do to him?
No, he just thought they were really disgusting. He said, quote, have you ever seen anything more revolting than an egg yolk breaking and spilling its yellow liquid?
Suzanne Plachette getting her eyes plucked out by seagulls.
But
I would think he was afraid of eggs because in every egg there is a bird there lurking.
That's true.
Very good.
Well, this is very exciting. It's not as exciting as what you're used to, but it's exciting for us. So, because if you get this last question right, you win. Here we go. Sigmund Freud, the explorer of the unconscious mind, had his own unreasonable fear. Was he frightened of A, the color red, B, pickles, or C, ferns?
I don't know why that's funny.
It looks so far-fetched, the other two. I would say the color red.
You say the color red, that Freud was afraid of the color red?
Yeah.
No, he was actually afraid of ferns.
Oh, that was my first thought.
Yeah, well, you see, you should have trusted your instincts. Ferns, to which we say, Sigmund Freud, sometimes a houseplant is just a houseplant.
No, but you know what? You should review the rules of the game, and if a guest says that it was his first thought, then you should go for it.
Really? You feel...
Because actually I won.
It you actually won. Thought. You feel... I'm beginning to get a sense of how you pulled all these things off now. Yeah. No, I'm afraid... I don't think we had a safety net, as I know you prefer. Hold on. We have an authority here. Carl, what do you think? He feels he deserves a point here. What do you
think? I don't feel.
He knows.
Man!
Well, unfortunately, he gave you the wrong answer at the end, so...
Oh, no.
You guys are so cold.
Okay. You wait, Peter. Some morning you're going to wake up in the middle of the night and he's going to be on a wire outside your bedroom knocking.
Back in the door.
Yeah, a red wire with a spider on it. Yeah. And lots of ferns.
Philippe Petit is a higher wire artist and the author of the book Man on Wire, which was made into a documentary. Philippe Petit, thank you so much for joining us today. What a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm up on tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on tight.
This week, it's a special all-male Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. We've got more Y chromosomes than a Chippendale dancer convention. In May of 2009, Carl and I, along with Kerry O'Connor, Roy Blunt, and Charlie Pierce, went down to Austin, Texas, one of the live music capitals of the world. And there we met Robert Earl Keen, known as the singer-songwriter all the other singer-songwriters want to be. He told us how he was inspired to get into the business.
Well, I liked music, and I went to a lot of shows, and I saw people that went to shows and noticed that the girls were all watching the guys holding the guitars.
Right. Rolling Stone once called you the Grateful Dead for frat guys. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I like it.
Well,
I guess it's songs you can sing along to, especially when you're drunk. Is that it?
Right. If you run out of mushrooms, you can drink Keystone.
Yeah.
Tell
me about... Since you came to Austin right away to start your career, and you've been here more or less ever since. I'm told that you went to Nashville for a while.
Uh-huh.
And how was that?
Really interesting. A lot of interesting people. And how many NPR stations are in Nashville?
I want you to assume, and we'll make sure this is true if it isn't, that nobody in Nashville can hear you right now.
Okay, fine. So, but I mean, at Nashville, as far as like to play music and stuff, it's kind of difficult. I came from Austin, you know, playing every bar and every club that I could possibly, you know, hang my shingle on or put my PA system up outside of. You know, I played at Spanky's Hot Dog Place one time, you know. I played at a garage sale one time here in Austin, Texas. So when I went to Nashville, I wanted to play like that, and I went to this place, and they said, oh, come here on Sunday. I know this sounds like a joke, but come here on Sunday, and we'll listen to you. So I came there, and there's a line out the door to play at this place, and after I played, they said, we have approved you for our open mic night. I said, are you kidding me? And they went, no. And they said, you can come here and play your two songs that you choose Sunday a month from now. And I went, Jesus, I need to get a job.
Wow. and did you?
Yeah, I got a job.
What was the job?
I literally dug ditches. I remember digging this ditch and hearing my dad's voice going, you know, if you stay with music, son, you'll be digging a ditch. And I was...
Actually digging a ditch. A metaphor no longer. It was real.
I was digging a ditch. And then I was working with some guy named John Henry on this dock one time. And he said, man, I know that you ain't like no dock worker. You're like one of them white boys that's like writing a book about being a black guy. And I said, that's not true.
He said,
well, you don't look like you belong here. I said, well... I don't know what I'm doing here. He says, well, you could give me a ride home.
Yeah. and that was the basis for your famous song, John Henry, the Suspicious but Perceptive Dock Worker. I love that song. It's a great song.
Often requested.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So, no, we understand you actually have a ranch here.
Yes, I do.
You have a ranch.
Uh-huh. My wife and I lived there for 10 years. And, uh-huh. and then when there was a point at the ranch where there's this very, very fine line between isolation and solitude. And, right. and we found it.
What is that line?
That line is when you wake up one morning and you hear your wife with a deer rifle shooting at cats. And you step outside, your back door, and she's just in her bra and panties. With a deer rifle.
Shooting at the cat.
I said, man, this has gone some hillbilly. It's pretty hillbilly.
I was going to say, that sounds more like the thin line between isolation and Mississippi.
And I've been there, too.
There you are. You're watching your wife shooting at the cats in her underwear, and you think to yourself, I've finally made it, or I'm going to back slowly into the house and lock the door until she's over this.
No, I got out my guitar and wrote a song.
Did you really? Well, Robert Earl Keane, we are delighted to have you with us. We have asked you here today to play a game we're calling...
You have just been tapped for the Skull and Bones.
If the bars and concert halls of Texas are on one end of the American experience, then far, far on the far other end is the Skull and Bones Society of Yale University, the most famous and elite secret society in the world. We're going to ask you three questions about the club to which both George W. Bush and John Kerry belong.
I knew that answer.
You did that?
Yeah.
All right. Get two questions right, you'll win a prize from one of our listeners. Carl, who is Robert Earl Keane playing for?
Robert is playing for Samuel Mintz of Austin, Texas.
There you are. Here's your first question. People think that Skull and Bones is a secret conspiracy devoted to vice, and of course they're correct. Evidence. It was founded in 1832 by a rich student with money made from what? A, the opium trade, B, stealing Indian land, or C, cheating at poker?
I'd have to go with cheating at cards.
Cheating at cards.
I think those Yale guys are always cheating at cards.
They might well have been, but the money used to found Skull and Bones came from the opium trade.
There it
student
goes.
William H. Russell founded the society with money his family made from trading opium.
Now I'm down to two.
You're down to two chances here, but that's okay because you're a.
The easy one?
You know, you're a singer-songwriter. You want to be desperate. It'll help. Next question.
Okay.
They try to stay out of the news, but sometimes Skull and Bones get some unwanted publicity. For example, they were recently sued for what alleged offense? A, stealing the skull of the Indian leader Geronimo for use in their occult rituals. B, frightening a student so much with their initiation that he had to sleep with the light on for all 4 years of school. Or C, drunken members persistently showing up naked at midnight at the local 7-Eleven asking for Twizzlers.
You know, if it was Austin, I would know this answer because they, you know, they stole that big bug down there.
A big bug?
They, about once every 2 years, they used to steal this giant bug from, like, this Terminex sort of place.
Oh, like a big fake bug in front of an exterminator.
Yeah.
And they'd steal it, and what would they do with it?
They'd keep it and probably smoke opium.
From it. Yeah. That's how they roll down here in Austin.
Right.
Opium smoking, bug stealing, songwriting, ceramics making, hemp wearing. The first one was they were sued for stealing the skull of the Indian chief Geronimo for use in their rituals.
Okay, I'll go with number
one. You go
with
Geronimo?
Yes.
You're right. That's what they did. Long-standing rumor that the members of the club stole Geronimo's skull a century ago, and Geronimo's heirs recently filed suit to get it back. Skull and Bones say they don't have it. They say that. This is very exciting. You get to the last question right. You win.
Okay.
Now, each member of Skull and Bones gets a nickname by which he is known to other bonesmen. When President George H.W. Bush was a member in the 1940s, he was known as Magog. That is the Bones nickname reserved for the bonesmen with what distinction? A, the wealthiest member. B, the dullest member. or C, the most sexually experienced member of the club?
Oh, my God.
George H.W. Bush, Poppy Bush.
Right. Man, that's a really tough one, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
You'll be able to write a song about this.
You know,
sitting in an armchair.
Three.
They're going to go for they want sexually experienced?
I think three's the right one.
You're going to go with most sexually experienced?
Yes.
You're right!
Yes. Whoa! Oh!
Bones members are required to relate their sexual histories upon initiation. Apparently, Poppy Bush went on at some length. Carl, how did Robert Earl Keen do on our show?
He had two correct answers, Peter, so he wins for Samuel Mintz.
Well done. Well done. Robert Earl Keen is a singer-songwriter, the pride of Austin. He's recorded over a dozen albums. His new record, The Rose Hotel, will be out this fall. Robert Earl Keen, thank you so much for being with us. Sure, actor Bruce Campbell has never won an Oscar like Sean Penn, and he's never starred in a blockbuster like Harrison Ford, and he's never been named People's Sexiest Man Alive like Carl Castle, but he has had a duel to the death with his own demon-possessed hand. When the star of such classic works of cinema as the Evil Dead movies, plus Bubba Hotep and a dozen other works of low-budget genius, joined us in February of 2009, along with Roxanne Roberts, Roy Blunt, and Paul Prevenza, we asked him how he got his start working with his college buddy, the director, Sam Raimi. Sam Raimi, of course, has gone on to make big Hollywood movies, but his first big movie was The Evil Dead, which is a great cult classic.
A B-movie, yes.
And you and Sam Raimi go off into the woods, and you make this low-budget zombie movie in which you play the hero and the sole survivor, Ash. Is his name, right?
Yeah, but you know, it wasn't actually a college movie like most people think. The investors just recently got a check that puts them we calculated about 30 times their original investment.
There you go. Mm.
People can laugh all they want, but there are about 16 people in Michigan who love B movies.
I bet. Just to give people a flavor of Evil Dead, there's a famous sequence in which your hand becomes infected by the zombie bug, whatever it may be.
Yeah, it gets attacked, so his hand gets possessed. And it beats him up in a kitchen. So there's a lot of broken dishes and plates. And
your own hand beats you up. You then chop off.
Yeah.
You chop off your own hand with a chainsaw.
With a chainsaw, because that's the handiest thing at the time.
It's right there.
That's where you find it, right in the kitchen.
And then
anybody would do the same.
And then you attach the chainsaw to the stump of your arm.
Right, because if you don't have a hand, then you got to have something. And if you're fighting beasts, you really got to cut to the chase and put the chainsaw so that the other hand can use the shotgun.
Right.
And you got both legs for kicking, so you're good to go. The occasional headbutt, you got about 8 weapons right there. But if you run out of gas, there's a big problem.
So Sam Raimi went on to make, among many other movies, the three big Spider-Man movies, and you have a cameo role in all of them, right?
Now, when you say cameo, I would challenge that.
All right.
I would go with Pivotal.
Pivotal, yes.
Well, because, you know, I've been in all three of them. In the first Spider-Man, I named the character.
Right. Just to explain, you are the ringmaster of the
ring announcer during when Spider-Man's trying to, you know, dress up as a spider.
And you give him his name.
So I name him. Part two,
yeah.
I'm the snooty usher.
Right.
You're a cameo in length.
Yeah.
But technically, I did not let Peter Parker in the theater to see Mary Jane in a play for the first time because he was late. So I'm the only character who's ever defeated Spider-Man.
That's true.
No, that's true. I don't like to brag on myself, but, you know, part three, I'm the French maitre d'.
Oh, right, yes.
Spider-Man, a.k.a. Peter Parker, he comes to me for advice and help and counsel.
I remember, for example, your great love scene in Army of Darkness, the entire dialogue of which if I remember, "Give me some sugar."
Give me some sugar, baby.
Excuse me. And that, of course, is the touch that makes it romantic.
But I want to say this. Give me some sugar, baby has some power.
It does.
I met a guy who thanked me for saying that line.
Yeah.
He was working in Beijing, China.
Yeah.
And he had that line translated into Mandarin. I'm not making any of this up.
All right, go on.
He went into a bar, yeah, and he said, you know, presumably whatever it sounded like. I don't want to imitate what it would sound like. I don't know.
Yeah.
But he got lucky. So I know that it has worldwide power, that line.
That's a pretty story, if I
were. That is.
It's just true. I'm only speaking the truth.
Well, Bruce Campbell, we are delighted to have you with us. We have invited you here today to play a game we're calling
I'm a Barbie Girl in a Barbie World.
Okay. We're going to ask you three questions about Barbie and her history. Get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice, and their home answering machine.
Very well.
Carl, who is actor Bruce Campbell playing for?
Bruce is playing for Greg Chain of St. Anthony, Idaho.
All right, ready to play?
Yes, of course, I'm very ready.
All right, here's your first question. Barbie's mother, if you will, was a woman named Ruth Handler. She was the co-founder of the Mattel Toy Company. She says that in creating Barbie, one feature of the doll was particularly important to young girls. What was it? A, that the doll's face not be smiling so that girls would learn they didn't need to be cheerful all the time. B, that the doll be sold eventually not just with purses and hairbrush accessories, but with tools and weapons. Or C, that the doll have large breasts so as to help the girl's self-esteem.
I'm going with C.
You are correct.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
It was Ms. Handler's insight that little girls would want to play with adult dolls, and it was important that the adult woman, she felt, have a full figure so as to seem mature and confident. There you are. All right, this is very good. Here's your second question. Life hasn't always gone so smoothly for Barbie. In the 90s, Mattel faced controversy over Barbie's new friend, Cher a Smile Becky, who was in a pink wheelchair. What was the problem? A, Barbie's dream house did not meet ADA requirements for accessibility. Becky's wheelchair couldn't fit through the door. B, Cher a Smile Becky was not in fact smiling. Or C, Becky's odd Barbie-like proportions made her top heavy in the wheelchair, and it regularly flipped over backwards.
Well. I'm going to go with logic here.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with A.
You're going to go with A, that the wheelchair could not fit through the doorway of Dreamhouse.
Technically, that someone did the calculations and they went, sorry, that wouldn't fly.
You're exactly right. That's
what
happened.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you, everyone.
You're good at this. We have one more question to go. One way Mattel is celebrating Barbie's 50th birthday is by making what one-of-a-kind special edition Barbie? Was it A, the Jessica Simpson Super Pop Star Supreme Barbie, B, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel Barbie, or C, Alms to the Poor Barbie based on Mother Teresa?
You know, I'm going to go with C.
You're going to go with C?
Yeah.
The Mother Teresa Barbie.
Yeah, because it's about compassion, and that's important.
I'm afraid the answer was actually B, German Chancellor Angela Merkel Barbie.
My goodness.
The doll has Merkel's hair and trademark dark suit, but observers note, it's much thinner than the actual
and
chancellor.
And does the doll flinch when George Bush grabs it from behind?
I know. Carl, how did Bruce Campbell do in our show?
Well enough, Peter. Bruce had two correct answers, so he wins for Greg Chain.
Very good. Congratulations, Greg. You deserve it, Greg.
He does. Bruce Campbell is one of the stars of Burn Notice on the USA Network and the star of the Evil Dead movies. His new movie, My Name is Bruce, is out now on DVD. Bruce Campbell, thank you so much
for
joining us.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you with us.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Bye-bye, Bruce. Thank you so much. This week, of course, is Guys Night Out, featuring some of the most memorable male guests from recent shows. You know, it's a tough job that requires a tough man to do it. Talk show host. Seriously, I've been taking so many steroids on this job, it's a wonder I can manage my rage. When Jimmy Fallon joined us in July of 2009, he was still getting used to the rigorous training regimen required to host late night at NBC. Along with panelists Roy Blunt, Charlie Pierce, and Roxanne Roberts, he told us he knew what he wanted to do from his earliest years.
It's weird. My mom, of course, told me, it's always your mother that remembers these things. She said, do you remember your 8th grade yearbook? They made a prophecy and said James Fallon will most likely replace David Letterman.
Wow.
And it was weird. Yeah, well, my principal was Nostradamus. So
that's
something to do with it.
But you, I'm told that you were like, you were telling people, I'm going to be on Saturday Night Live. And by a ridiculously young age, you were on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I mean, I used to tape the show and watch it every Saturday at my house. My parents would let me, you know, drink underage if I didn't leave the house.
Right.
So my parents would buy me a six-pack of beer. I'd sit by myself with a bag of chips, and I'd watch Saturday Night Live. And I know I'm such a nerd. And I would tape, but I thought it was cool. But, you know, I'm almost like a human TiVo. I would tape it and just bring them the parties. I'd physically come in with a videotape and be like, you got to watch this. And I'd put in some, you know, funny Mike Myers, Dana Carvey thing or something.
Wow. Well, let's talk about this. So I'm not quite sure how it happened. Lorne Michaels and NBC said, yes, you were the guy. You were going to be replacing. I guess you were replacing Conan. Conan went to The Tonight Show. You went to Late Night.
Yeah. When I was leaving Saturday Night Live, I you know, my contract was up. And I said, Lorne, I'm going to go. And he's like, well, what do you want to do? And I go, I probably want to, you know, do movies, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what I was going to do. And he's like, well, Conan signed a contract. He's leaving. He's going to host The Tonight Show in 5 years. So in 5 years, I think he'd be a great replacement. I go, oh, maybe. I don't know. And then I tried movies, and that didn't work out too well. So so 5 years later, Lorne, I called him up. I said, hey, is that offer still stand? And he was like, yeah, absolutely. You're my first choice. And so I just immediately stopped watching all the guys that were on currently, because if I did watch Letterman or you know, I would end up imitating them. So I had to just stop and just start from scratch and just try to figure out my own way to go. And so I'm still figuring out, but we're still on the air.
Well, you do some odd things. There's audience make under. You take people out of the audience and you make them uglier than they were.
Yeah.
Have you yet to come up with something that's actually too bizarre for your producers? Are they letting you do anything you want?
No one's watching.
No, well, that's
fantastic. We're allowed to do it. No, I mean, we just kind of, I mean, we've done stuff that just flopped. We had this one I thought would be big, but it didn't work. But it was an alien who was going to take over. He was going to take over the Earth.
Yeah.
But as he's about to take over the Earth, he's like interrupted all the monitors. You know, the channel NBC. And as he's doing this, his wife is yelling at him behind the camera. It's like, who are you talking to? He's like, will you shut up? I'm trying to take over the Earth. He's like, oh, my. And they get in a huge domestic fight. And he never gets to, it just embarrasses himself. It didn't work at all. It really tanked. I mean, it was crickets.
I got to ask you about this. When you were on Saturday Night Live, and I want to ask you if it's fair, but you had the reputation for cracking up in skits. Is that true?
Yeah, I definitely did. I mean, let me just first say out there that I'm not a good actor. So, I mean, if something's funny, I'm...
No, that's not true. We saw Taxi. We thought...
No, that was not a drama.
No.
No, it was a comedy.
Oh. Does the fact that I wept mean that there's something wrong with me?
I don't know what to tell you, but when I'm working with, like, Will Ferrell and, you know, Horatio Sanz, they would just... Will would change things up on air to make me laugh because it was live show.
Right.
So, like, we do, you know, the cowbell sketch, for instance, where he's playing a guy who's banging a cowbell to a Blue Oyster Cult song, and he's just hitting the cowbell way too hard so you can't even hear the band. That's the joke.
Right. Yeah.
But on air, he wore this really short shirt.
Yeah.
And every time he would lift the cowbell, his gut would fall out. And I was laughing so hard and trying not to laugh. Like, I couldn't turn. And, of course, when it was my turn to talk, he pulled the sunglasses off and looked at me, and he was sweating. And he was a sweaty, crazy man with his gut hanging out. And I was like, oh, I just lost it.
Well, Jimmy Fallon, we are so glad to have you with us, but we have invited you here today to play a game we're calling...
The first 20 audience members into the auditorium tonight were given genuine Carl Castle sports coat elbow patches.
Last weekend, as I'm sure you know, the 30th anniversary of the infamous Disco Demolition Night at Chicago's Comiskey Park. That became a riot, caused the forfeiting of a game, which remembered as one of the dumbest ballgame promotions in history. In honor of that bit of local lore, we're going to ask you three questions about other baseball promotions. Answer two questions right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Carl, who is Jimmy Fallon playing for?
Jimmy is playing for Danielle Rouse Hollifield of Jacksonville, Florida.
All right, ready to play?
That was my first girlfriend.
Really?
Yeah, it's a weird coincidence.
Now you can make it up to her, man. Here we go.
Oh, my God. Very nice.
First question, one of the worst baseball promotions ever, maybe the worst, was at a game on June 4th, 1974, in Cleveland. the Indians versus the Rangers, what was the promotion? A, Chinese throwing star night. B, unlimited 10-cent beer night. Or C, cage match fight night.
I would have, first of all, I would have loved this night, and I would have shown up. I'm going to guess 10-cent unlimited beer
night. Yes, 10-cent beer night is gone down in history.
That is a nightmare.
The game had to be forfeited.
Honestly, who could have predicted that 10-cent beer night would go wrong?
Yeah, drunken fans.
I mean, that is a mistake.
Yes. The umpire finally called the game after a hunting knife landed near his foot. Out of here.
You have the seventh inning stress, the eighth inning fight.
And the ninth inning projectile vomit. Which is really awesome.
All right. Another promotion that went awry happened, as is often the case, at a minor league park when the West Michigan Whitecaps decided to do what at one of their games in 2006? A, release 20 dogs and 20 cats into the stands just to see what happens. B, drop $1,000 bills from a helicopter. Or C, fire popcorn at the fans with an air cannon.
I'm going to say they dropped $1,000.
You're right, Jimmy. They did. They dropped $1,000 into the stands in the ensuing melee as adults grappled with children for the money. Two people
what
were hospitalized.
What year was that?
This was just a few years ago, 2006, they did this.
What's wrong with people?
I don't know. Last question. This is a promotion that happened last year. It was linked to a current event. Happened June 13th, 2008. It was for the Macon Music team. Was it A, Hillary Clinton pantsuit day, B, Elliot Spitzer night, or C, Larry Craig wide stance day?
I'm going to say it's... wow. I'm going to say it's Hillary Clinton pantsuit.
Hillary Clinton pantsuit day, where anybody wearing a pantsuit gets in free. No, it was actually Elliot Spitzer night at the ballpark in honor of Elliot Spitzer, who at that time was caught in his prostitution scandal.
Oh my God!
Because of Client 9, the ninth fan into the ballpark got prizes, and everyone who had ever resigned a position in shame got a discount. Carl, how did Jimmy Fallon do in our quiz?
Well, Jimmy, you weren't perfect, but you had two correct answers, and that's good enough to win for Danielle Rouse Hollifield.
I love you, Danielle!
Yo! Jimmy Fallon is the host of NBC's Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. Jimmy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you guys so much. I had a blast.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now we come to the most manly of the manliest mans we have had the opportunity to manhandle. John Cena. And frankly, he's a bit of a paradox. On the one hand, he's a champion professional wrestler with muscles on his muscles, and he spends his days smashing chairs over other guys' heads. But on the other hand, it's all make-believe. John Cena entered our arena in March of 2009 facing panelists Roxanne Roberts, Mo Rocca, and Tom Baudette. You rose through the various ranks, I know, in the various circuits until you became, if I've got it right, the longest reigning champion in the WWE, right?
Yeah, I really don't like to rest on my resume, but that's a good one to have, I guess. I guess I was thinking of my debut on public radio.
I know.
Of my life, but.
Well, that'll be what you brag about from now on. But today, what, if you can brag a little bit about yourself, what separates the superstars from the WWE from everybody else in the circuit? What do people respond to you?
They just we're in the business of telling stories. We're in the business of entertaining our fans, and you really have to identify with the audience on a certain level. And in the beginning of my career, I identified with them through hip-hop as a medium. I was the thuggish white rapper from West Newbury, which was a very hated character. And I kind of used that initial identification and month by month, year by year, kind of whittled it away into being myself.
So you actually modeled your initial persona in the ring on Vanilla Ice?
Yes, absolutely.
And you were like...
Absolutely, because I they wanted me to start rapping on the program,
right.
And I figured who was more hated than Vanilla Ice, besides the time Kevin Federline.
So you've been, and I'm proud of myself because I learned some wrestling talk. You've been both a heel and a face. You've been a hero.
Yeah, which to the newbies is I've been both a bad guy and a good guy.
Which do you enjoy more?
You know what? They're equally as rewarding. It's a lot tougher to be a good guy because our fans are very, very fickle.
Really? So you have to constantly go out there and keep their loyalty and keep their affection.
Yes, and it really takes a long, long time of really proving yourself out there to become a liked personality on our show.
I was reading today about some of the storylines in the WWE that you've been involved in, the rivalries and the feuds. Who comes up with those storylines? Who decides that today your enemy is going to be this character and this guy is going to help you and then it'll be find out that you're this person's illegitimate son? I mean, do you do that? Do you say, I'm going to hate
no,
you?
No, no. We have an entire creative staff that keeps track of the program in a grid-type format, so very similar to the way you'd write syndicated television.
Well, speaking of that, your second movie is coming out. This is actually a movie produced by WWE. The first movie was The Marine. The second movie is 12 Rounds. You handle yourself really well in this movie as an actor. And I'm guessing that the transition wasn't that hard because you're performing to begin with, right?
Yeah, it's basically what we're doing is more of a like a Broadway scenario or a live theater scenario. And you just gotta know when to calm it down when you're filming a movie. I mean, your face is a lot larger on screen, and the most minute movements can mean, right, you know, worlds of difference. So you gotta. It's basically an actor's transition from Broadway to the big screen.
I've never thought of it that way, and I think it's totally great. In the first movie, The Marine, you were a guy. I believe some bad guys kidnapped your girlfriend, and
yep.
you taught them a lesson. In the new movie, you're a Louisiana cop. Some bad guys kidnap your girlfriend.
You teach them. And I'm gonna teach them a lesson.
Yeah, I know. Do you think that by the next movie, they will know not to mess with your girlfriend? Do you think this will sink in by then?
Let's hope so. I mean, you got to go with what got you to the dance. If somebody takes my girlfriend, they're certainly going to be taught a lesson.
Right. I think we know that now.
Is there a whole lesson plan that goes with these movies? I'm imagining a curricular guide to go with them.
That'd be a great catchphrase. You know, just like, can you smell what The Rock is cooking? You can be, do you know what John Cena has in his curriculum? a syllabus of pain, ladies and gentlemen. Well, John Cena, we have asked you here to play a game that we're calling...
Sure. Pro wrestling is a good gig, but when you win, do they throw teddy bears into the ring?
No, they don't. That's my guess, anyway. They don't, do they? Generally?
No, they don't.
That's a custom, of course, reserved for the wonderful princes and princesses of figure skating. So like everyone, like everything else, like pro wrestling, I guess, figure skating has its own lingo. So we're going to ask you, John Cena, three questions about the language of figure skating. Answer two questions correctly. You win our prize from one of our listeners, Carl's voice, on their home answering machine. Carl, who is wrestler and actor John Cena playing for?
John is playing for Ken Sutton of Heron, Illinois.
Ready to go?
Let's do this.
Oh,
this
man.
Is my defining moment of my life. Let's do this.
You've heard, no doubt, of the sow cow and the triple axle, but there are other more obscure moves a figure skater might try in the ice, including which of these? A, the flutz, B, the Cohen, or C, the backstab?
I would go with B.
You're going to go with B, the Cohen?
Yes.
It sounds good, but it is, in fact, the flutz.
Oh, no.
The flutz. The flutz is... it's a combination of a lutz and a flip. It's kind of a cheated lutz. All right, now,
no.
You have two more questions. You have to get both these right to win, so just to focus your attention.
I got about 1,000.
I just want to focus your attention. I want you to imagine that Carl Castle here has kidnapped your girlfriend.
I'm about to teach somebody a lesson.
You are.
Yes. Watch it.
Somebody's going to pay. Fortunately, you're on the phone. All right, here we go. Things get a little more complicated in the related sport of ice dancing. That's where the pair of skaters might be seen doing which of these? A, the flying kiss back, B, synchronized twizzles, or C, Zimmer cutouts?
I really like the synchronized twizzles.
You do?
I know B. Yeah, I'm going to go with B.
You're going to go with B, the synchronized twizzles. You're right.
Yeah, yeah, it's synchronized.
Synchronized twizzles.
Yeah.
A twizzle.
A kid's still alive.
You're still alive. A twizzle is a kind of moving turn, and if you do them together at the same time with your partner, you've synchronized your twizzles. Now, this is exciting, because just like in pro wrestling, you've built up to suspense and a climax. We have done that here. Get this last question right. You will win it all.
Sometimes, the big finish.
I know. It's great. Uh-oh. He's picking up a folding chair. Sometimes... Sometimes you'll see a figure skater bend one leg, almost sitting on the ice while sticking the other leg out.
I love that.
Front. Mo likes this. So you're skating along, you're sitting on one leg out. This position is called A, the Russian haunch, B, shoot the duck, or C, the keister freezer.
C sounds attractive, but I'm going to go with the Russian haunch.
Haunch. No, I am afraid the correct answer was B, shoot the duck.
Oh, my goodness. Why would they do that to them?
I don't know. I don't know why they call it shoot the duck, but they do. They call it shoot the duck. Carl, how did John Cena do in our quiz?
John had just one correct answer, Peter, and he needed two to win for Ken Sutton.
This is not a problem. You know why? Because judging from your movies, you'll have another girlfriend soon. I think it'll happen.
So you're saying public radio is the only one that did mess with his
girlfriend? There you go. There you go. Ha-ha.
Ha-ha. Has there ever been, I mean, do you see a future in sort of in combining pro wrestling with figure skating? Or
I think that would certainly be a recipe for disaster.
I think that'd be
I guess it's called hockey.
Yes.
Yeah.
John Cena is one of the great stars of World Wrestling Entertainment. He's also an action hero in the movies. John Cena, you're a gentleman, you're a scholar. Thank you so much for being with us today.
I appreciate it, really.
Great to have you. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Medicare open enrollment ends December 31st. More at Medicare.gov or 1-800-MEDICARE. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 750,000 tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio. In association with Urgent Haircut Productions, Doug Berman, executive producer. Philip Godica writes our limericks. Our house manager is Don Hall. Our intern is Ashley Rayfeld. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Engineers include Les Dolarchik and Mohammed Mao. Thanks to John Zajac at Chase Bank. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Ian Chillog, Eva Waltover, and Emily Ecton. Technical direction from Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Thank you, Carl Castle. Thanks to all of you for listening. I am Peter Sagal, and we will see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.